From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A special legislative session on immigration also seems to signal a lessening of power for Governor Ron DeSantis.
It's actually about following the leader you trust. For my part, I trust President Trump.
Also this week, an attorney weighs in on Florida's efforts to reform immigration policy.
All reasonable people agree that our immigration system is not working. And I understand that the state is frustrated about that.
We'll also get the latest on how artificial intelligence might be used to find illegal firearms, and we'll discover why some kids in need are now spending their nights in human service agency offices. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and your end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Florida lawmakers and Governor Ron DeSantis have finally reached consensus, passing two immigration reform bills this week. But as Tristan Wood reports, the process to get there has reshaped the relationships and power dynamics among the state's top government leaders.
When DeSantis signed the first two bills, he was flanked by smiling legislative leaders, House Speaker Daniel Perez and Senate President Benjamin Albritton. He called the laws a team effort.
I absolutely anticipate other states will follow what Florida has done as we move forward in the weeks and months ahead. We are ahead of the curve on ending the illegal immigration crisis. We didn't just sit our hands. We got to work. We hashed it out, and we've got a great product going forward.
That's a stark change of tone from what the governor was saying when legislative leaders rebuffed his first immigration proposal last month, instead passing their own. The governor's spokespeople attacked lawmakers on social media. DeSantis even posted videos blasting their proposal.
Now, they've named this bill the Trump Act, but that's a misnomer because President Trump's been very strong coming out of the gate on immigration enforcement. He wants to solve this problem once and for all. The bill they did is more window dressing. It is not going to solve the problem. We're not here for theatrics. We're not here to do messaging bills.
Legislative leadership like Albritton at the time were saying they wanted to take back the independence of the legislature.
Sometimes leadership isn't about being out front on an issue. It's actually about following the leader you trust. For my part, I trust President Trump, and I trust Florida law enforcement.
Looking at the package passed, University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett thinks the legislature won. While the package has some of what DeSantis wanted, like making it a crime to be in the state as an undocumented immigrant, it also foregoes many of his original proposals and requires the governor to share immigration enforcement powers with all of the state cabinet positions.
In my estimation, having written about and followed Florida politics for 30 years, Governor DeSantis has been one of the strongest governors we have had. But now, his power is a little bit curtailed because one of the ways he was able to get everything he wanted was just telling the legislature, and they just did it, even if in some cases they didn't agree with it or thought it was the best idea. That doesn't seem likely to happen anymore, and thus DeSantis' power relative to what it used to be, you know, is not as strong.
While lawmakers and DeSantis came together on this package, Jewett is skeptical it will address the root causes of undocumented immigration, employment. While the bill makes it a crime to be undocumented in the state and gives harsher criminal penalties to undocumented people in Florida, it does very little to provide enforcement of E-Verify, the system that companies with more than 25 employees are required to use to prove their employees are documented.
It's perhaps a recognition that the certain big sectors of the Florida economy rely very heavily on labor from illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants. Agriculture, construction, the tourism industry, particularly when you talk about, say, hotels and restaurants. And so there seemed to be a real reluctance to go after the employers on this.
Florida's next legislative session starts next month. Political experts will be watching closely to see how the shifting power dynamic between the governor and the legislature's Republican leadership shape the discussion. I'm Tristan Wood.
Protesters have been gathering lately outside the historic Capitol in downtown Tallahassee. They're upset about immigration raids, federal orders, and state legislation. Tallahassee immigration attorney Elizabeth Ritchie has become the go-to expert in Florida and oftentimes nationally on immigration. She spoke via Zoom with WFSU's Gina Jordan.
Raids aren't anything new. Immigration's been doing raids as long as there's been an agency. But the optics have changed. For example, the number of deportations in the last few weeks is about the same that it was a year ago, but the subject didn't have the attention that it has now. So what immigration officers, ICE in particular, is doing now more visibly is pursuing people who have previous orders of removal, deportation orders, or who have serious criminal histories. So that's who we're seeing pursued. Obviously, people are going to get caught up in that who don't meet that criteria and don't have serious criminal histories or prior deportation orders. That will happen, just the numbers will bear that out. But in the meantime, they are not the priority. So I am not actually seeing an increase in raids of people who are undocumented but don't have serious histories or court cases.
Okay. And so FHP and DMV put out these press releases about these raids, but technically it sounds like there could have been more raids than we were told about.
Sure. And ICE pulled the data from their website, so we don't know for sure what's transpired. The issue with FHP having additional immigration authority, with all due respect, is that they are not trained in this area. So what we expect to happen is that people will be detained for too long under the law, and that the state will be sued because attorneys will pursue habeas corpus petitions against the state for holding people longer than they are allowed to be held.
We've had protests in Tallahassee and around Florida over state and federal immigration policy. We also recently had a lot of folks participate in A Day Without Immigrants. So one of the protesters we spoke with said, a lot of immigrants are working jobs that would directly impact a big chunk of the population if they just decided not to show up for work one day. Can you give us some insight about that?
Well, in our state, our critical industries are full of people who are undocumented. I'm talking about construction, the hospitality industry, and the farming industry. It's kind of funny. Somebody sent me a reel this weekend of a comedian who said that when he first came to the United States, his job was cleaning toilets at a preschool. And he apologizes if he took your job that you wanted cleaning toilets at a preschool. And the joke is on Americans, right? We don't want immigrants in this country, but we don't want to clean toilets and we don't want to do hard labor. And I'm certainly not saying that that's what immigrants do, but that is the perception. I'm sure many of your listeners have doctors and accountants and lawyers who are foreign, many of whom may actually be non-permanent residents or non-citizens. And I wonder if they would want them to be removed from the United States.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, how hard are things for people, you know, for legal immigrants, people who are documented?
Hard. I'm getting calls from mostly people who are legal, who are worried about how long they're going to be able to maintain their legal status. Most of the calls I'm getting are from people who have TPS or pending asylum cases and are worried about TPS being revoked for their country. As we saw, the president did just announce a termination of TPS, temporary protective status, for Venezuela. And they're worried what will happen if their asylum case fails. So it is not that I'm getting calls from people who've actually been swept up. It's calls from people who are wondering what would happen if what they do have that allows them to be here legally is terminated.
That was Tallahassee immigration attorney Elizabeth Ritchie. Her law firm is a regular underwriter of WFSU, and you can hear more of that conversation at WFSU.org. Well, after the idea didn't pass during the 2024 legislative session, a bill that would restrict the types of flags that can be displayed at government buildings and schools is again moving in the Florida Senate. The measure passed its first committee stop this week on a party line vote, with Republicans supporting the bill and Democrats opposing. The bill would prevent displaying a flag that represents a political viewpoint, including, but not limited to, a politically partisan, racial, sexual orientation and gender, or political ideology viewpoint. The bill, though, doesn't specifically name flags that would be barred from being displayed at public buildings and schools. But Senate sponsor Randy Fine says some of the flags that would be banned include those for Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ Pride, or those that are pro-Palestinian.
The idea here is that the government should not be in the political message business. Politics should be for the politicians. The government's job is to serve the people.
State Senator Tina Polsky says the legislation is mean-spirited and unnecessary.
This is not a good piece of legislation. You know, frankly, it's really just about people being scared of LGBTQ kids and not wanting any talk of it in a classroom.
The measure has two more committee stops in the Senate before it can be taken up by the full chamber. A similar bill in the House is yet to be heard ahead of the 2025 session that starts March 4th. Coming up on Capitol Report, artificial intelligence could be an effective way of detecting illicit firearms. Republicans aren't happy with that, but some public safety proponents believe it's a good thing.
We're going to give them that dispatch, and they can do with it what they will. Whether they involve law enforcement or not is not our call. We just pick up the gun.
Florida's agencies that help kids provide lots of services, but being a place where the children spend the night isn't supposed to be one of them.
It's troubling, to say the least, because I don't think kids would be treated that way. It's not their fault.
The desperate search for something, anything, to halt the spread of citrus greening disease in Florida's shrinking citrus groves may have turned up a solution. The problem is that solution could take years to have a positive impact.
It takes months and months, sometimes years, to see a result, and most of the time the results are negative. So when you have something that works, it's a reason to celebrate.
And a civil rights champion in the Florida legislature has died.
I think we have to teach authentic history.
Florida lawmakers are looking into a plan to limit artificial intelligence technology used to detect firearms. It's part of a Republican push to protect Second Amendment rights. But as Adrian Andrews reports, others argue it's a useful tool for public safety.
Spring Hill Republican Senator Blaise Ingolia is partnering with Palm Bay Republican Representative Monique Miller to file legislation that would block AI gun detection in most public spaces. On social media, Ingolia called the technology an infringement on Second and Fourth Amendment rights, and he's not the only one who feels that way. The Florida State Director of Gun Owners of America, Luis Valdez, agrees.
The use of artificial intelligence and a security apparatus literally seems draconian and deep state, something that you would expect to happen in North Korea or Russia, not in Florida.
But Sam Olimo, co-founder of Zero Eyes, one of the companies behind the gun detecting technology, says the software helps keep people safe, and he says it's limited in what it can see. For example, it only picks up on brandished guns, not the ones that are concealed.
So what happens is our software algorithm says, I think it's a gun, when it sees something in the shape of a gun. An alert pops up here, a still frame image, and then the human in the loop in our ZOC either decides it is a gun and dispatches it, or it's not a gun and makes it a false positive.
Zero Eyes works with most security cameras or live streaming devices. the program, despite being just 7 years old, has become popular among some school districts in Florida. The Leon County School Board has hired Zero Eyes to install the system in 3,500 cameras throughout 42 middle and high schools. Chris Petley, a spokesperson for Leon County Schools, praises the software, calling it a game changer for school safety.
It's really technologically heavy, but we have done tests at our campuses in partnership with Leon County Sheriff's Office, where we have the individuals from Zero Eyes, and we run these kind of practice scenarios.
The AI detection bill includes a carve-out for places where concealed weapons are prohibited, meaning under the measure, the technology could still be used on school campuses or at police stations, airports, and courthouses. But municipalities would be barred from using gun detection cameras in places like Daytona's Seabreeze Entertainment District. Daytona's Police Chief Jakari Young says the technology would have been helpful during a 2023 incident in which a woman took out a gun there and started shooting. Young talked to Daytona City Commissioners back in January about the incident.
Imagine if we had this technology in place and I already have officers in the area and we're already en route prior to shots being fired.
Young urged city commissioners to install Zero Eyes around town, something Angolia's bill would make illegal. While Young says it could save lives, Gun Owners of America's Valdez thinks it can cause confusion and uncertainty.
If we get open carry introduced and legalized in Florida, what will this system then especially do?
Currently, Florida doesn't allow open carry, but most adults 21 or older can conceal carry their firearms without a permit, meaning guns must be hidden inside a holster of some kind. Some Republicans, including Governor Ron DeSantis, are pushing to pass open carry this year, but House and Senate leaders have not yet agreed. WFSU asked Alimo of Zero Eyes if the state were to adopt open carry, would it make their gun detection software less effective? He says no.
So we have deployments in open carry states, and we have some clients who want every alert that comes through of an exposed weapon. For instance, a grocery store, it's an open carry state, but they want to be informed and they want the alert, the dispatch, when someone walks through the door with an AK-47. And that is something we're going to do.
The gun detection bill is filed for discussion in the regular legislative session that starts in March. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Republican State Senator Corey Simon says he's troubled that children have been staying overnight in the offices of Florida's community-based care agencies. He raised questions in the Senate committee that oversees the Department of Children and Families, known as DCF. Department Secretary Siobhan Harris responds to the concerns in an interview with Margie Menzel.
Simon was reacting to a DCF presentation about young people for whom it's difficult to find placements if they aren't safe with their biological parents. These include kids with behavioral or other severe problems that can make the home unsafe for the foster family. DCF has a new treatment for these children. The Behavioral Qualified Residential Treatment Program has 12 residents statewide and more facilities in the pipeline. But Simon says he's hearing from foster families that are struggling to get help for their troubled kids.
What parents are calling and telling me is that we're calling, but nobody is picking up, or they're leaving me on hold for long periods of time and then they're hanging up. And so I want to understand just how many positions do you all have vacant?
A DCF representative didn't have an answer right away, so Simon went on to his questions about community-based care agencies, known as CBCs. These are privatized agencies with whom the state has contracted to handle adoptions and foster care placements. They often involve children who are troubled due to years of abuse or neglect.
Our CBCs have no clue what to do with them. They are sometimes just sitting in the offices of our CBCs overnight in many instances because there's no placement for them. And so I think there needs to be a real sense of urgency in taking care of this problem. And I know that wasn't a question, but the magnitude of the problem is frustrating.
The following day, DCF Secretary Siobhan Harris said the department's hotline staff vacancy rate is at an all-time low, 8%. And that the department has been aggressively hiring for these positions. Harris also says DCF's hotline for reporting abuse and neglect is different from the calls Simon was describing. He was talking about children and youth in foster care. Harris explains that the community-based care agencies are responsible to those foster children and parents, while DCF is responsible for calls to the abuse hotline.
We really want individuals using the hotline to report abuse and neglect. If you are a parent, if you are a foster parent or adoptive parent in need of assistance, our contract with the community-based care lead agencies requires them to be the first line of defense. So they're really the first entity that you should be calling because their contract requires them to help support you.
Harris says DCF and the community-based care agencies are partners. For instance, Florida doesn't have enough foster parents, so the department works with the CBCs to recruit them. But if the parents Simon describes can't get their calls answered by the CBC, who is responsible?
I know you say your partners, but are they primarily responsible?
Yes, that is a part, that is a core part of their contract.
Are they primarily responsible for kids sitting in their offices?
They are responsible for ensuring that children have a safe home. If a child does not, it is their responsibility as well.
Harris says there are other ways to get a call returned. One is a callback assist, in which you leave your contact information. Harris says your call is typically returned within 25 minutes. There's also an option offered when you call the hotline to use an online reporting tool. That way, there's no wait time. She says someone will call back the same day and provide confirmation that the report was submitted. Simon, who is a former football star and has worked with youth in sports activities, hopes the connections will improve for foster families.
It's troubling, to say the least, because I don't think kids would be treated that way. It's not their fault.
For more information about the correct numbers to call, visit WFSU.org. I'm Margie Menzel.
Genetically modified citrus trees could help fight the insect that causes greening disease. The Asian citrus psyllid has devastated Florida's iconic citrus industry, slicing production by 90% since the early 2000s. WUSF's Jessica Mazzaros tells us how these new trees are providing hope.
On either side of a sandy dirt road, Valencia orange trees tower overhead, with flecks of orange and yellow peeking through leafy green branches. 32-year-old Morgan McKenna Porter has spent her whole life in citrus groves.
The Florida citrus industry was originally started with the guy that just wanted to have 5 acres, 10 acres, 100 acres, and be a Florida citrus grower. That model is why there's an orange and orange blossoms on every license plate. We're the flagship industry. And it was part of the Florida dream. It was the white picket fence of Florida to own a grove.
She's the operations manager at her family business, McKenna Brothers, in Lake Wales. It's owned by her father and uncle. They not only manage their own groves, but also caretake for others.
At its prime, and really up until about 2 or 3 years ago, we were just over 5,000 acres. Now we're closer to that 1,500 area. We were harvesting and hauling over 2 million boxes, and now we get excited when we hit 500,000.
That decline is thanks to citrus greening disease. The Asian citrus psyllid, a tiny brown-winged insect, infects these trees with a bacteria that essentially strangles the root system.
This yellowing in the leaves, instead of seeing that nice, really vibrant, dark green, is typically a sign of greening.
McKenna Porter says it's standard to assume that every tree has been infected. But researchers at the University of Florida have been working with growers like McKenna Porter to workshop solutions over the years. At a lab in Lake Alfred, researcher Lucas Stalinski introduces me to the latest in greening science, a genetically modified citrus tree.
Looks like any normal citrus seedling that you might see growing up in a citrus nursery prior to planting.
Behind some zipped-up netting is an unassuming plant with lots of green leaves sprouting up 2 feet above a black pot. But this is no ordinary seedling. This one is a killer. It's been genetically altered to create a protein that forms holes in the gut of a psyllid.
When we started seeing dead psyllids, those are the days you live for, because science is very slow and it takes months and months, sometimes years, to see a result. And most of the time, the results are negative. So when you have something that works, it's a reason to celebrate.
While the initial adult psyllids can feed on a citrus tree, none of its offspring are able to survive into the next generation. So the trees do get damaged, but they survive.
It serves essentially as a population sink.
Stalinski believes that genetically modified trees would be part of a host of solutions that are needed to combat greening. His team's research has been peer-reviewed and successful in the lab, but the real test will come if the trees survive the next 3 years in citrus groves. And even if it works, it will take more time for a grower's genetically edited trees to bear fruit.
So what we're talking about here could be a decade, 15 years away before you start seeing those changes. So in the meantime, people are going out of business, and that's the heartbreaking part.
It takes so long because it's not something they can just inject into a mature tree. They have to all be grown from seeds. In the meantime, growers like McKenna Porter continue to fight to keep the trees they have alive.
We'll have additional Band-Aid type therapies to keep us essentially on life support until there is that tree that's available.
She says she hopes that down the line, this new technology will not just benefit growers in California, Arizona, Brazil, or Mexico, that there's an industry in Florida to save. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Lake Wales.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a longtime icon in the Florida legislature has died. Orlando Democratic Senator Geraldine Thompson was a towering figure in politics and an advocate for African American history. Joe Burns reports she died yesterday at age 76 from complications following knee replacement surgery.
Senator Thompson was first elected to the Florida House in 2006 and served multiple terms in both House and Senate. She was a former college administrator who founded the Wells-Built Museum of African American History and Culture in Paramore. She authored a book on Orlando's Black history. In 2023, she spoke with Central Florida Public Media.
I think we have to teach authentic history. We have to be real and present an unvarnished version.
The Reverend Dr. Robert M. Spooney, pastor at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church, says Thompson was more than a politician.
I've always looked at her as more so of being a voice for the people, a champion for the people, whose mantra was always doing the right thing.
Congressman Maxwell Frost issued a statement saying, quote, "We lost a giant. She was," he says, "a force, a trailblazer, a historian, a fierce advocate, and a devoted mother and grandmother." A statement from her family says she died peacefully, surrounded by family members. In Ocala, I'm Joe Burns.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jessica Mazaros and Joe Burns. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week, online and on air, for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.